Okay, time for the truth about markets in London, 104.4. Resonance, 104.4. Here at 104.4 at Resonance. Truth about markets with Max and Stacy. Stacy, how are you? What's happening?
Max, I'm very well. This is a big news week, by the way.
Oh, it's so chock full of news.
It's chock full of financial terrorists and war criminals. I see Tony Blair was, testifying, quote-unquote testifying.
Oh, yeah, Tony Blair. Well, what's the name of the inquiry? The Chilcot. The Chilcot. Right. So apparently they basically just gave him the equivalent. I can't say much on this show, can I?
Well, yeah, no. But basically, I can't even actually read anything to do with Tony Blair. I can't look at pictures of him. There's nobody who bugs me more than looking at him. And he seems to have said, like, despite all the evidence that has emerged and all the lies that have emerged, we still would have gone in because 9/11.
Well, his defense, you know, and what his rationale and his defense boils down to one basic premise, that Tony Blair is God. Now, during the Chilcot inquiry, after a little nervousness on the onset, and when it became clear that the inquiry was not going to ask him any of the questions, like about the dodgy dossier or about anything that pertained to his activities as a war criminal, he just fell back to his tried and true technique of bullying those around him with his belief that he is God. And this is the same thing we're seeing in the City of London and on Wall Street. The Goldman Sachs is doing God's work. How dare you question us? You know, Tim Geithner was in front of Congress and people were pointing out to them and to him and saying, look, Geithner, look, here it is. You stole this money. You aided and abetted thievery. And he just looks at everyone and says, well, yeah, but I'm God. Don't you get it? God.
We had the best of intentions, he said.
So, and no one, you know, this is the problem when you have an economy that has no hard money attached to it. So anybody in a position of power can say pretty much anything they want to say as long as they are doling out the graft and the kickbacks. There's just no way to have any kind of accountability between the government and the governed.
Well, it's also the big problem with banana republics. You know, banana republics are owned by corporations. They're countries that are owned by one corporation or a handful of corporations. And there's just no way to touch these guys. It's the same as trying to appeal to, you know, Marie Antoinette about her corrupt officials. She's never going to attack them. The oligarchs, the royalty are always going to be, you know, exempt from the normal laws of the peasants.
Oh, yeah, and this term banana republic, of course, it refers back to the United Fruit Corporation of America, whose biggest, really, their business was the business of bananas and exporting bananas from Central America countries, Latin America.
And importing them into America, yeah.
So, and United Fruit, which changed its name to Chiquita, basically took, you know, was a coup d'etat. They took over the company, essentially, the model that was used throughout Latin America, Central America.
Yeah, they threw over, was it Arbenz, who was ruling Guatemala? They overthrew the democratically elected president.
Right.
And I'm sure in America, there were lots of, like, the equivalent of what tweets now and commenters on forum boards saying, like, they're communists. We're overthrowing these communists. They're dictators, evil dictators.
Yeah, you saw the same thing with August Pinochet in Chile. You know, he's a Milton Friedman disciple, and this God, markets are God, and we worship the market God. And you see the same thing in Iran now with the so-called Twitter revolution where, again, the corporations want to get in there and take over because Iran is the last bastion, one of the last bastions of an independent oil producing country. So we can't have that, can we? Oh, you know what? I know something very interesting that, I gotta believe that bin Laden is dead. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that?
Who knows? You know, we did speak to a childhood friend of his when we were in Doha, and that was in, 2007. And at that time, he said he was still alive and had just recently got married in the last year, and they had twins, children. So they got married in Quetta, he said. So maybe, I don't know why. Why do you ask?
I kind of think I'm in the camp that thinks he's dead. But I think that, but he's a very useful dead person. He's a very useful cadaver for the purpose of propaganda.
Sure, sure.
So you have last week, for example, the statement from bin Laden that
the alleged statement. We don't want him to sue us for libel.
Who, bin Laden?
Yeah.
So apparently, as reported by Al Jazeera English, the statement from bin Laden was that he has encouraged people and countries to abandon the U.S. dollar in favor of other currencies.
Are you serious? I didn't see this one. You have to send me the article.
Yeah. Yeah. According to the bin Laden camp, countries should abandon the dollar and embrace some other currencies. And now, this is part and parcel with also the comments we heard from Hank Paulson last week, and we're going to get into that in a second, but let's just build it up here. So now, the fact of the matter is that the U.S. dollar, the world reserve currency, 75% of all the transactions around the world are in U.S. dollars. It's the basis of the American imperium. It's how America manages its global empire. It's, you know, any country wants to buy oil, for example. Well, since oil is priced in dollars, they have to buy dollars first before they buy oil. So countries like Japan, they just can't go out and buy oil in the open market. They have to buy dollars first, and then using those dollars, they buy oil. So it's a way for America to control the global economy. And naturally, America loves having the world reserve currency. They love the seigniorage, which comes with the commission on printing all those dollars. They get a quick, 2% kickback on just the commission business there. It's like when you go to change your money at a Cambio, change place, when you go traveling overseas, they always take 2 or 3%. So America has that franchise, but on a global basis, and the $3.5 trillion per day Forex market. So they're just, cold clocking dollars day in and day out just for having this monopoly position in the world reserve currency that was set up after World War II. So, they don't want to give that up. So now there's a huge, there's a very strong case to be made that the dollar should be abandoned by countries that don't like to be colonized by the dollar. You know, countries like Iran, for example, who doesn't want to be colonized by America, has said they want to get out of the dollar. Saddam Hussein said he wanted to get out of the dollar shortly before shock and awe. China, of course, has a very interesting relationship with the U.S. vis-a-vis the dollar and their local currency. They peg their RMB currency to the dollar. And, of course, 50% of all the money collected in America from taxes goes directly into military, which goes into colonization of the world and subjugation of the world, and that's all dollar, U.S. dollar based. So when guys like Peter Schiff come out and say, you know what, not all, you know, it doesn't make any sense economically to buy the dollar. When Jim Rogers comes out and says, it doesn't make any sense to own dollars. Or when Mark Faber and these people come out and say, it doesn't make any sense to own dollars. The comeback now, apparently, from the U.S. Public Relations Department in Washington is to say, well, bin Laden recommends that you dump dollars. So to dump dollars, therefore, the syllogism here is that dumping dollars is equal to being in league with bin Laden. And so they've made dumping dollars a quote-unquote act of terrorism. And I think that before the end of the year or next year, we're going to start to see some capital controls. People who want to take their money out of the U.S. are going to be stopped. You know, it's happened in the 70s.
I thought you were going to say, I think that before the end of this year or early next year, I'm going to meet Jim Rogers and Peter Schiff in a gulag somewhere in Lithuania.
Uh-huh.
Well, if they're going to start equating, recommending dumping the dollar as an act of terrorism.
Yeah.
And they've done it with enough other stuff. And, you know, there's a lot of brown shirts in America and elsewhere who will support it. They already support, you know, locking up and being hard on, you know, eco-terrorists, they call them. They're all happy to be, you know, lock up other sort of liberals. So now that they're going to start going for the libertarians, we'll see how happy they are for the libertarians and right wing to be locked up.
Yeah, well, you know, they have an amazing way to take all the available imaging and slogans and turn it around. So, you know, Greenpeace, for example, have images of Greenpeace workers out in the field developing sustainable energy, and then Exxon will co-opt those images and they'll run a commercial on TV, and you think it's an ad for Greenpeace, and then at the end it says, oh, we're Exxon Mobil, we're working for sustainable energy. And so they adopt those terms, and of course the whole eco-terrorist term has been co-opted from the idea that ecologists have been working against companies like, you know, Exxon that are gravely, you know, destroying the ecology. So then the Exxon people say, oh no, the people who are working to try to stop us are eco-terrorists. And so now, as you know, on this show for the last several years, we've been talking about financial terrorists, mm-hmm, on Wall Street in the city of London. So within the next few months, you're going to hear from right-wing television in America, the Sean Hannitys and the Bill O'Reillys, they're going to come out with a term called financial terrorists, but they're going to apply it to people like Peter Schiff and Jim Rogers, who are advocating dumping the dollar. This is the term financial terrorism, which I coined, was the first on broadcast TV with it, the first in print with it. They're going to turn that around, turn it upside down, and turn it into a term to suit the agenda of financial terrorism. And again, because they own the media, and the media is 99.9% owned by the corporate interests, there's very, you know, it's very difficult to have a balanced kind of discussion about these things. They're going to use it because it's a brilliant term, thank you very much. And they're going to use it to for their own nefarious ends, of course. So I have to come up with something new, of course. And but it brings up another point, Stacey, which is like, you know, we've gone through these different wars, like the war on drugs, which was actually just the CIA developing the drug trade in Afghanistan to fund the war machine. They had the war on terror, which was just the CIA with false flag operations as a way to justify supporting the military. And now you have to go, this war on the people who are wanting to dump the dollar. What's it going to be? War on financial terrorists, I guess, is what they're going to say.
The war on savings and sound and prudent finance, basically. They don't want you to be able to control anything. They want to control... The war on prudence. Well, by the way, you know, and you mentioned Fox News, but I believe Glenn Beck has done specials on basically dumping the dollar and how trashed it is.
Right. And, you know, it served their purposes for a time being. But at some point, there will have to be some kind of flip-flop.
Yeah, but I'm saying that this is, you know, you know, it's obviously not as outright fascist as Italy or Germany in the 30s, but it's definitely fascism light. And those libertarians who were supporting dumping the dollar, you know, were many of them, like the Glenn Becks, were all for, you know, liberals being locked up or environmentalists being locked up. And they were egging that on. Mm. And because when the state came for those people, that was okay.
Right.
But now when the state will come for them, we'll see, like, how much sympathy they get from their fellow Americans already locked up.
Well, they'll flip-flop. You know, like there's that Bill O'Reilly clip of him saying that global warming is real, and because it was controversial at the time. And then when he needed to kowtow to his corporate sponsors, he flip-flopped and said, oh, no, global warming is fake. So now you've got Glenn Beck. He'll say, dump the dollar because it's a radical position last year or the year before. But once it becomes a genuine threat, then he's going to have to flip-flop and say, embrace the dollar. The dollar is our only defense against financial terrorists like Peter Schiff and Jim Rogers and Mark Faber and all these people. And there'll be a massive flip-flop, and they'll totally turn these words inside out. And they'll basically, you know, this is the classic, you know, the whole idea of using the words of your the person you're debating and just totally throwing them back in the person's face, but in a nonsensical way. But if you say it loud enough and with enough shrillness in your voice, you can somehow, you know, blow your way into, you know, bluster your way into something.
That's right. I turned on the light.
Oh, that's cool. So anyway, now I see in today's Financial Times that there's a book review written by John Kay of a book called Free Fall, which is by Joseph Stiglitz. So now, you know, when we started doing this show, The Truth About Markets, about a year later, John Kay published a book in the UK called The Truth About Markets.
I think he published it before our show.
Well, that's not, in fact, true, but it does no matter. It's a good title for a book and a show. But we've got this book coming out now from Joe Stiglitz, Free Fall, which is talking about the whole crisis that we've all just experienced. And so he talks about all the various bits and pieces that went into the crisis. And
I see the name Greenspan.
There's just not enough light. You know,
there's not enough light. I mean, let there be light.
There's just not enough light in the room. I mean, you know. All right.
Is that better?
Well, yeah, light, you know, it's let there be light. Somebody once said that. And there was the ability to observe and understand things again. And
now there's only darkness. That's why they call it a dark age, don't they? The new dark age.
Well, you know, for listeners to this show, it's a review, basically. We've been, you know, talking about this. He mentions the famous Greenspan put. You know, the Greenspan put is something we've been talking about the show for years. And when the market was going up pre-2007, traders openly talked about the Greenspan put as a strategy that they were employing, that doesn't matter how many bets that they made that went bust, they would always get bailed out by the Fed, by Greenspan, who would just make rates cheaper, make it cheaper to borrow, to paper over the losses. And this became known as the Greenspan put. A lot of people refer now to gold as having kind of a built-in floor, because anytime it gets cheap, China comes in to buy more. They refer to that as the China put as it relates to gold. But anyway, as it relates to this book, Free Fall, they're talking about basically, let's see, where can I pick this up? The story of the run-up to the crisis has now been told often. The collapse of the dot-com bubble at the turn of the century led to plentiful cheap money, the growth of securitization, debt repackaging, and increasingly complex financial instruments that made it difficult to assess underlying risks. The aggressive promotion of new mortgage structures was viable only on the assumption that constantly rising house prices could allow frequent opportunities for refinancing. Stiglitz's account is distinguished by its emphasis on the underlying economics.
Why are you reading like that?
This is for the people who listen to this show, who take drugs. This adds to the hallucinogenic effect.
Oh, they might think they're like spinning around and like it's like, you
get
know,
dizzy.
Yeah.
It's a way to boost cheap drugs. You know, when you're buying cheap drugs, like the you know, what it's called, dirty.
Like the stuff that kills all of Pete Doherty's friends.
Yeah, that stuff. When you're buying, what do we call it? Stinkweed or that other stuff. You know, like homegrown. No. homegrown, you know, like basically, you know, banana peels or...
banana peels.
Stuff you find in your kitchen cabinet and you're smoking that. See, this helps to boost the effect by giving you a dizzy sensation by speaking in this cadence, as I'm doing now. But anyway, Stiglitz, who I interviewed on one of my previous shows for BBC World News, he says... the emphasis on the underlying economic... He judges that Greenspan's worldview was characterized by two basic errors. First, Greenspan underestimated the significance of the agency problem. There's a piece of jargon for you.
Was that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac he's talking about?
No. It's the agency problem is the term given to the situation where, as they explain, and I'll let the article explain. The incentives of mortgage salesmen, of the inventors of structured products, and of the executives who allegedly supervise them were not aligned with the long-term interest of the institutions for which they worked. Right, so... the short-term interest of the engineers putting together these packages who were the brokers, their interests were not aligned with the people who were buying the products. You know, their interests were just to create some flim-flam product and get a quick fee, and they had no, and once they sell it, they it doesn't matter if it works or not.
Your individual incentive as basically a salesman was churn. So you were churning as many of these as possible. The fact that they were all toxic didn't matter, but it was bad for the long-term health of the company that was selling it even. So Bear Stearns, for example, or Lehman Brothers.
Yeah, they committed banking suicide.
That's right. But in the process, you know, some people became very rich. They're like,
a few of them, yeah.
Well, that's a classic... case of a virus, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it was an internal financial virus. The institution died, but a few of the insiders walked away with a lot of money. So the agency died, and as a result of this mismatch of incentives. And he goes on to say that Greenspan, of course, quoted from 19... interest in the institution... The bemused former chairman recognized this problem in 2008, quote, I made a mistake in presuming that the self-interest of organizations, specifically banks and others, was such that they were best capable of protecting their own shareholders and their equity in the firms. Right. Remember, he made that statement in front of Congress when asked, well, what did you get wrong in your worldview? And he described that he didn't understand that he was dealing with suicide bankers. And okay, if you use the suicide bomber as a parallel example, which I think you have to, the suicide bomber, his own self-interest is not aligned with anything because he's blowing himself up.
Yeah, but you know, self-interest is based on like the notion of a cell or a living organism wants to survive. It's in their self-interest to keep their genetic line going. But like I said, with a virus comes in and it becomes part of the body, but it then turns the body against itself. So it self-implodes.
Yeah. And these suicide bankers, just because they're not blowing themselves up in one go, they are blowing themselves up over a number of years, and they're blowing up the economy of the country in which they live. So the American economy is becoming a dictatorship because of the suicide bankers. And they're also blowing up the ecology of the planet that they live because of the externalities that are being forced into the ecology that are making it inhabitable for humans.
Plus, you know, the suicide bankers, the ideology they're trying to spread is they're trying to, you know, have a caliphate of fundamentalist markets. So, and in fact, it's working. It seems to be, you know, people are falling into their arms and joining the jihad against sound economics and sound finance. And more people are actually demanding lower rates and more printing of money. And, You know, so they're actually achieving what they want.
Yep, the banking jihad is recruiting more and more people, demanding cheaper rates, and the creation of ever more copious quantities, trillions more of ersatz currency. That's right.
So that's correct.
Banking jihad is winning. Now, Stiglitz explains that the second error made by Greenspan and those who thought like him was, now this is getting kind of interesting, was a misinterpretation of the motives for trading new financial products. The orthodox view was that the development represented a more sophisticated tailoring of risk to specific needs of individual holders. Now, listeners of this show know over the past few years, every time the Financial Times would have an article introducing some new derivative product like a synthetic collateralized debt obligation, and they would trumpet the arrival of this new product as a new way to shuttle risk and manage risk. And on this show, and many times, I would point out that this was, in fact, bogus. It's just a way to basically rape the system, as we now all know. But when they are introduced to the pages of the Financial Times, there's a lot of excitement about, oh, wow, look at this new engineered product. So the Stiglitz prefers to believe that trade was driven by, quote, information asymmetry. Now, this is another euphemism for market manipulation and insider trading and fraud. But I guess he has to use these more highfalutin terms too, because he's paid to be an academic.
Well, of course, terrorism is also called asymmetric warfare.
That's right.
So he's saying they're terrorists.
Well, that's right. Those prisoners who starved themselves to death in Guantanamo, according to Rumsfeld, were engaging in asymmetric terrorism against America.
No, you're talking about that situation that emerged just recently, that the three guys murdered, and Rumsfeld said that they had committed asymmetric warfare against America by committing suicide, but in fact they had killed, they had been murdered?
That's right.
By three, by some CIA agents.
Right. So this asymmetry is an interesting term that is used in economics and politics and in economics. This symmetry of information, of course, is one of the underlying foundations of the so-called efficient market theory, that markets reflect prices reflect all available information in a symmetrical way that creates prices, and of course that's been discredited as well. But anyway, so this information asymmetry propagates the greater fool theory. People who understand a little about the nature of the product are dumping the risks on people who understand even less.
Mm-hmm.
So in the orthodox view, complex securitizations reduce overall systemic risk. In the revisionist view that we now understand, in fact, it increases the risk.
That's correct.
Because basically, you have to think about it in terms of the princess and the pea. You know, the princess and the pea, there was a pea underneath 10 or 20 or 30 mattresses or 40 mattresses, and the princess was complaining about the pea. Now, you put this in context of the global economy, the pea essentially is the Earth's carrying capacity for humans. And there is a limit to that. But to mask the limitations, bankers create options and derivatives and money spinning technologies, fractional reserve banking, and fiat currencies to create a mattress that gives people the sensation that they are somehow insulating themselves from the reality of Earth's natural carrying capacity for humanity. And this has to continuously be adjusted, because the underlying asset, the Earth in this case, or the pea, is degrading, which requires more and more layers or mattresses of buffer between reality and the discomfort of those who are essentially in the business of engineering these mattresses or layers of derivatives. And they tell you that they're making you, protecting you from the pain of having to sleep on the pea. What now we now know is that it has increased risk, not decreased risk, and you are now in a much worse position than you ever were before. Now, the events of 2007 and 8 would show decisively that the revisionists were right. Right. Okay. Now, Stiglitz recounts the failure of policymakers to acknowledge the magnitude of the crisis even after the initial freezing of credit markets of summer of 2007. Of course, we were doing our show here at that time, and we walked you through exactly what was going on before, during, and now. So we had no problem explaining it to you because we figure since you're completely stoned, you would have no biases toward understanding the truth spoon-fed to you in a way that makes perfect sense. Perhaps this criticism is unfair. You don't contribute to either financial stability or economic recovery by telling people that things are worse than they think. So says the... I don't know. That's a stupid... I'm going to just write a big X through that because whoever wrote that...
John Kay did.
Well, John Kay needs to put the crack pipe down. All right. But then Lehman collapsed. For Stiglitz, the notion that if only Lehman... Well, then they go into a Lehman thing, which is boring. Okay. Ready? Obama administration... was ready to acquiesce all power to Wall Street. We know that.
To Wall Street self-promotion and the inadequacy of its fiscal stimulus. Well, like, again, it says that's like my virus, the situation where, you know, the virus wants to keep in a symbiotic relationship. They want you, the host, to stay alive, to keep feeding it. But it can threaten to overwhelm you and destroy you, of course.
Let's talk about that scoundrel Hank Paulson. He was in the news this week making some bold statements.
Yeah, well, this kind of reminds me, when you brought up this the situation from Guantanamo Bay where, what was it, 2 or 3 years ago when those three guys... quote unquote, committed suicide all at the same time within an hour of each other, you know, in the middle of the night.
By handcuffing themselves and hanging themselves and all that?
Yeah. The death certificate said they were handcuffed and their feet bound, but they, during that time, somehow killed themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But remember at the time, how angry the spokespeople from the military, the Department of Defense, the Pentagon were like, this is asymmetric warfare. We take this as an attack on us.
Mm-hmm.
And they were very convincing that this was an attack on them. But now it emerges that they actually were murdered, these three people.
Right.
But this reminds me of Hank Paulson's accusations in front of Congress this past week saying,
mm-hmm.
Russia and China were trying to take down our economy. And that's why we had to take it down. You know, they were the ones taking it down.
That's right. All the Hank Paulson was telling people that Russia was trying to get China to sell Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac bonds to try to disrupt the American economy.
Yes, so he's alleging that somehow they have high-level information from unnamed sources that Russia was trying to get China to sell the Fannie and Freddie bonds in order to force America to rescue them.
Right, that's right.
It's a war on prudence. It wasn't just prudent economic sense for them to dump these bonds.
No,
there must have been some nefarious reason for it.
This was
an attack on us. It wasn't because of our bogus products.
On American values. It had nothing to do with the economics.
No,
the fact that you had trailer trash, you know, living on the edge of a cliff in a $3 million trailer, collateralized by a pea, that had nothing to do with it. By frozen brick of peas in the freezer, that was the collateral supporting a $3 million mortgage on a trailer trash on overlooking and sitting on the cliff. That had nothing to do with it. No. So, yeah, Paulson. So, well, I mean, this opens up. This is, as we've been saying, I think last week or the week before, the war is on. The war of savers versus speculators has begun, and that the vilification of savers, which I believe Keynes referred to it as the paradox of savings. It wasn't the paradox of savings, but the
paradox of thrift.
Yeah, the paradox of thrift, you know, that if everyone's going to save money and they're not out there spending beyond their means, how can you grow an economy well above its carrying capacity? You know, I mean, you got to go out there and rack up those debts, y'all. And but so this is rearing its ugly head on a new global scale because, of course, China has a huge savings account. So if you have a savings account, you must be like the Chinese. And of course, the Chinese are trying to attack America, and they're terrorists because they're financial terrorists. They're the war against prudence.
But he also attacked the Brits. Okay, so he in front of Congress, he attacked he blamed the Russians. For trying to get the Chinese to sell their bonds. Now today I saw a review of his book. You know, he's out with his book about the situation.
Who, Paulson?
Paulson.
Oh my god.
So he was literally talking his book in front of in front of Congress.
Was the anarchist guy to Wall Street?
But today
steal this book and I'll get paid triple on the insurance by Hank Paulson. You know, what's this guy doing, man? Somebody, how about a little polonium 210 action, huh? You know, that's what I'd like to see.
Well, he's already lost his hair. Somebody must, he's like made of kryptonite. He survived that, but he lost his hair.
God.
But today he blamed in the book, he apparently blames the Brits. He says the Brits screwed us on Lehman Brothers. He said Lehman Brothers collapsed only because of the British. Because he said, you know, when he and Geithner were talking about it and when Lehman was happening, they were ready to do a Bear Stearns sort of like merger. And so they were working on this merger with Barclays. They said it's against the law in the U.S. at the time for the Fed to just bail out Lehman Brothers, which is why they couldn't bail it out. But he said, you know, so we were trying to merge it with Barclays. And he said we were screwed by the British because they were refusing to overlook a law there where the Barclays would have had to present it to the shareholders.
Mm-hmm.
So he's saying the British screwed us for not overlooking their own laws.
Right.
But we couldn't, disobey our own laws, break our own laws.
Right. Okay. So he's blaming the British. He's blaming the Chinese. He's blaming the Russians. And he's blaming anyone who's against the dollar, like Bin Laden, of course, and Ahmadinejad.
Yeah, it's all like everything's so spontaneous and without any sort of weird cause. We're just, it's like, well, Helen Thomas, that, you know, the famous question a few weeks ago where, you know, after the Christmas bombing, right? The attempted bombing of the airplane. And, all these mainstream media taking the talking points from Robert Gibbs and just like writing them down and not questioning. And Helen Thomas says, well, why do they hate us? What, you know, why do you guys keep on saying, why are they trying to attack us?
Yeah. What's their motivation?
What's their motivation? And there was like, well, because they're evil.
Right.
So this is like what you're starting to see emerge with all of this finance and economics. It's all just mysterious. Mysteriously, the Russians just want to hurt us. The Russians are mysteriously telling the Chinese to dump our bonds.
Mm-hmm.
And the Brits mysteriously just wouldn't go against their own laws. Like, everything is so, it doesn't make any sense. We're some sort of victim here.
Right. This is really unsettling because not only are these guys in Washington cowards, not only are they committing acts of unlawful behavior and securities fraud, but they're cowards on top of it. You're not even like James Cagney in some gangster movie where at the end he gets fried by the state and but goes down, you know, as a man, not as a coward. Or he pretends to be a coward because he's trying to set an example for the kids. You know, it's a beautiful story.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's nice.
What's it called? Like, in the heat of the something or other. But, you know, just to be also not only unscrupulous, but cowardice. And these are the elected, these are the representatives of America. It just, you know, as an American, it makes you just want to throw up. You know, it's like, this is the best the country can offer, are thieves and cowards. I mean, come on, guys. If you're going to steal, at least have some, you know, spunk about it. Have some class about it. You know, I'd rather see John Gotti, the dapper Don, run the Treasury Secretary. At least when he's lying to Congress, he can play with his pinky ring and show off his new suit and, you know, make it a nice show. Like, this is what's great about Berlusconi. He's a crook. Yeah, of course. But he's, you know, he's a stylish crook. He's out there getting hair plugs. You know, he's out there fooling around with some teenager. You know, he makes it all look nice and fun. You know, I mean, I can go with that because it's a charade. But to go, but to be a unscrupulous guy and a coward and to bully people with this, you know, just a mangling of the language, and
well,
it's so
but
pathetic.
I think it kind of reminds me of some really, really disturbed serial killing psychopath. Like, you know, they lock somebody up in their basement, chain this woman to the floor, feed them some scraps, and, you know, do all sorts of horrible stuff to them. And then when the woman gets angry or whatever, they're like, why do you hate me? Everybody hates me. You know, they're like some psychopathic serial killer who has some very, very serious mental disease.
Yeah, like Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, they're guy. Like, they are. Like, that's Hank Paulson, that guy.
That guy, when he put his weenie between his legs and thought he was a woman. Remember that shot?
Now I'm picturing Hank Paulson doing
and
that.
And he's saying to the woman in the little cave, it puts the lotion on! It puts the lotion on! Because he's trying to starve her, and he's going to flay her and remove her skin to make a woman suit while he's stuffing his weenie between his legs. And that's Hank Paulson. He's that guy. And the American
right.
people are in the pit. And they're being asked to put the lotion on.
All the world is in the pit.
Yeah.
So, I think the American people are more like hanging on the side of the wall, thinking they're out there with the crazy guy, thinking that the crazy guy is going to protect them and keep them from being the woman in the pit.
Well, you know, the thing is, in that movie, of course, there was a big rescue at the end of the movie because it's a Hollywood movie. But I'm afraid that...
Yeah, by the FBI.
By that carpet muncher, what's her name? Jodie Foster.
Max.
What?
No, so this woman is rescued by the FBI, but the FBI is definitely there with the crazy Hank Paulson in the dress and the
right.
weenie between the legs.
Yeah. So the whole rescue thing. Well, you know, I mean, I see this photo in the Financial Times.
I think it's a drawing.
I mean,
cartoon.
Yeah, a cartoon. It's Hank. It's a Greenspan, and he's in the pose of Mickey Mouse from that movie Fantasia.
They're stealing your stuff, Max.
Yeah, you know, I've often made this illusion that Mickey Mouse, you know, in Fantasia, he splits the broom into two, and it creates doubles the problem. And it keeps chopping the brooms and keeps making more problems and keeps flooding the system with more bad paper. And the Sorcerer's Apprentice. And there's nothing, you know, it becomes a whirlwind of a catastrophe. And there he is. There's little Alan Greenspan with his Mickey Mouse Sorcerer's Apprentice hat on and his magic wand. And the only thing missing is that music, the... Something.
Oh, because you're not allowed to use it. Too expensive.
Probably owned by Disney. Probably bought the rights to the Halls of the Thunderdome or something, or whatever the music is. It's great stuff. We played it on this show, YouTube, you know, at least three or four times over the past 5 years to illustrate musically this phenomenon of the Sorcerer's Apprentice exacerbating the problem because they're children. Doing men's work. That Paul Volcker's a man. He can do the job. I don't know if they keep threatening to bring him in.
Oh, yeah. Well, somebody pointed out that Timothy Geithner in that interview we linked to on the Kaiser Report, and then the following in the State of the Union address, also Obama refers to the Congressional Financial Reform Plan. He doesn't mention the Volcker Plan again, and neither did Geithner that night.
Right.
That was like a fake out. It was trying to... maybe it was just a way to try to get the bankers to understand this is coming next if they don't agree, if they don't stop lobbying against the congressional plan, which is totally bogus.
How pathetic. Hey, let's talk about Ellen Brown's article because she quotes me at length. Who is
oh, really?
This woman and why is she writing about things about me?
What do you mean, who is this woman? You interviewed her for
Tell
on
the people,
edge.
Tell the people. I know who she is, but tell the people.
Well, she writes about... debt mostly, and money,
yeah.
Actual the creation of money and that kind of thing, and how
right.
to Now, she was one of the earlier people to adopt this whole notion of the North Dakota bank system, sort of like the state-owned bank.
Oh, yeah.
And not leveraging up the banks and the people actually owning their bank rather than relying on bankers to, for some reason, people prefer to pay bankers a percentage of everything. But yeah, she's speaking of the Volcker Plan, she's written this article, The Battle of the Titans, J.P. Morgan versus Goldman Sachs.
Mm-hmm.
And she's saying that, so Volcker was a former J.P. Morgan guy,
mm-hmm.
and that he's being brought in to wage battle against the Goldman Sachs guys like Geithner, Larry Summers, you know, mm-hmm. all these, the blank finds of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, well, what she quotes from a screed that I blurted.
Yes, she did, about high frequency trading mm-hmm. and market making.
What show was that on? I forget which one of my shows. I can't keep track of these TV shows.
I think it was last week's Truth About Markets.
Oh, really? Does she listen to this show?
Yes. Hi, Ellen.
Wow. Why didn't anyone listen to this show? I just thought our neighbor heard us through the wall, and then some bonged out, you know, drug addicts down in Shoreditch. But other than that, I didn't think anyone listens to this show. Anyway, right. So in my screed, I pointed out the
Saudi American financial analyst Max Keiser.
Yeah, yeah. I was talking about the attributes of high frequency trading, that once you control the buying and the selling by putting yourself in between the market making mechanism on, let's say, the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, and by flooding the system with orders, and we know that 70% of the orders are so-called program trading or high frequency trading, you have the ability then to adjust the market making dynamic. Typically, a price is set when the specialist matches the buys and the sells. If there's more buyers than sellers, you'll see an uptick. If there's more sellers than buyers, you'll see a downtick. And if there are no buyers or sellers to offset the trade, then the specialist steps in and fills that order, him or herself, from their own inventory, and acts in the role of a principal as opposed to acting in the role of a broker. Now, with high frequency trading and program trading, firms like Goldman Sachs will flood the system with orders and in effect co-opt that natural buy and sell or supply and demand function you see on the floor. And they can adjust the parameters of the dynamic that produces the price so that they can create a negative or a positive bias. So if you want to crash the market, you will adjust the dynamic so that it takes less down volume versus up volume, or takes less sells over buys to generate a downtick than would normally be the case. And conversely, if you want to create an upwards bias, you adjust it so it takes less buy orders versus the sell orders to create an uptick. And by adjusting the bias, you can adjust the pitch or the slant of the market. And why do I know this? Because it's the virtual specialist technology that I invented. The patent number is 5950176. And it's used by firms to adjust the pitch or slant or direction of markets. And it works if you're in there with 70% of the volume and you've co-opted the entire underlying market-making functionality. And so when Obama pulled out Volcker, Goldman Sachs set the bias to negative. The markets went down for 6 or 7 or 8 days in a row, and suddenly you don't hear about Volcker anymore.
Yeah, but she's saying like it's a war between those two sides, because which if you look at it, so the Treasury and the politicians are all Goldman Sachs, right? You know, clearly Goldman Sachs. They're all owned by Goldman Sachs. Timothy Geithner, when questioned by Marcy Kaptur, had to go through the list of Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs was always the answer. Who is your assistant? Who did your assistant previously work for? Goldman Sachs. Who did Hank Paulson previously work for? Goldman Sachs. Everybody was Goldman Sachs. Mm-hmm. But the Fed, I have to say, Ben Bernanke this week said he had nothing to do with the AIG, Goldman Sachs funneling of money. The U.S. Fed didn't have anything to do with it.
Yeah.
Now the Fed is J.P. Morgan. more than, it's not Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs was an investment bank up until last year. So JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, maybe it's a war between those factions.
Okay, now, you know, her conceit in laying out her thesis is something that I'm not completely on board with as such. I mean, it's an interesting thesis, and it brings up something else. But
I want to also mention one more thing I was talking about. So Jamie Dimon keeps on being dropped as this name that's going to replace Geithner.
Yeah.
And he's J.P. Morgan.
Yeah.
Where does Tony Blair work?
J.P. Morgan.
J.P. Morgan. So yeah, there could be an ascendancy of these J.P. Morgan. It's always a long-term battle. It's been going on 100 years between the two banks.
Right. But in terms of making the markets go up and down, I guess what she's saying is that the J.P. Morgan is making the market. See, if I followed this through, it would be, in other words, if J.P. Morgan wants to swap out the Goldman guys with their guys, and they want to swap out Geithner for Jamie Dimon, and they want to swap out Bernanke, although it's too late now because he got reconfirmed, but with somebody who's more in their camp, then they would crash the market, cause a crisis, and cause mayhem, and these swaps would take place, and you know, that's kind of what she's saying is what's being played out there. Which is, I'm not totally on board with that idea. I mean, it's an interesting idea, and I'm not dismissing it. I'm just saying I'm not totally on board with it at the moment. But I mean, when I hear about J.P. Morgan or Goldman Sachs, of course, having worked on Wall Street myself, I can tell you that there is a bitter rivalry, but it's based on ethnic lines.
Well, but why is it that J.P. Morgan has, you know, twice, has the largest derivatives book in the world, yeah, by far, mm-hmm, and much bigger than Goldman Sachs's. But why did Goldman Sachs need, what was it, $15 billion funneled to them from their AIG exposure on derivatives, credit default swaps? But you never heard anything about J.P. Morgan, any of their derivative stuff going bad, when they hold almost all of it.
Yeah. Well, because of this thing called the shadow banking system, which is where all these deals take place. And Goldman, because of their political influence, was the head of the spear, the tip of the spear, in engineering the bailout because they have the political clout. Morgan does not. They don't have the same revolving door with Washington, but they work with Goldman. See, Goldman and J.P. Morgan work with each other in the shadow banking system, doing deals all day long. They're not competitors in any stretch of the imagination. None of the banks on Wall Street compete with each other. They're all working together to fix prices and manipulate markets. So that's one of the problems I have with this idea, is that they're even on a cosmetic basis, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And on a structural basis, I know it doesn't make sense, but I mean, it's an interesting idea. Mm. But yeah.
Yeah, they collude. And you know, Adam Smith, of course, said that, you know, you put two businessmen in a room and they're going to fix prices. So that does call into question all of those meetings in private, with no secretary taking notes, with Hank Paulson, Timothy Geithner, and the heads of the five biggest banks. Like, what were they talking about? What were they colluding about? What prices were they fixing?
Well, you know, the point is that we have to keep in mind is that at the moment, all the remedies for the crisis of the past 2 years have been to avoid the only solutions that make sense relative to the crisis. Now, the only solutions that make sense relative to this crisis are threefold. Number one, raise interest rates. Number two, raise reserve requirements for banks. And number three, raise margin rates for speculators. Those are the only three things one has in their quiver to use as remedies for the problem, which has been a result of the converse. The too low interest rates, too little reserve requirements, and too low margin requirements. Those have, over the past 60 years, but in particular the past 20, and in particular the past 5, those elements of the financial world have been transformed so that banks' cost of borrowing is less than zero. If they're using various currency carry trades, for example, between the yen and the dollar, their cost of borrowing is negative 2 or 3%. Their reserve requirements are less than zero when you consider that they account for the same offshore balance sheet accounts are accounted for multiple times on multiple balance sheets. If you were to strip out all the multiple accounting of all of these offshore special purpose entity accounts that are held simultaneously by funds and banks in a way that obviously is impossible, you would find that not only are they have very little in reserves, but they have negative reserves. This is how you can have a $700 trillion derivative market in a $60 trillion global economy. And finally, the margin rate. What's their cost of borrowing to speculate? Again, it's negative zero. It's less than zero. Because for the same reason that with using various currency arbitrage techniques, etc. So you have in it's not only the tail. It's not that let me. We only have a couple minutes left, but starting in the 1970s and the adoption of and the creation and proliferation of exchange traded option contracts on the Chicago Board of Options Exchange and the introduction of the options volatility formula Black-Scholes model, which gave rise to modern derivatives, you entered a period which you could say was a financial period of the tail wagging the dog. But starting with the Clinton repeal of Glass-Steagall and Greenspan's increase in the reserve, the leverage parameter from 12 to 1 to 30 to 1, which he did in 2004, What the situation now is that there's a flea that's living on the tail of that's wagging the dog. The flea is wagging the tail that's wagging the dog. There's a flea, and it's five or six guys, and they're wagging the global dog, and they're making billions, hundreds of billions of dollars, and the wealth and income gap is skyrocketing, wages are collapsing, the ecology is being blown to bits. And that's the fact, Jack. And that's the truth about markets. And now we'll be back next week with more of the same. And we got about a minute left, Stacey. So I want we're done?
We're done. We can end whenever we want. We can actually end at 32 minutes if we feel like it.
I like the whole idea of being precise, though. I don't know. Maybe it's
your German.
Maybe it's something in my psyche. This whole idea of just vagueness, I don't go with that. I don't truck with vagueness. I like, especially when I'm watching a freaking clock, I figure I must be watching it for some reason. You know, like
turn
there must
your
be
eyes,
a reason for me
eyes.
Looking at this thing, count down to 58 minutes. I mean, I hate to think that I'm doing this in vain, that there's no purpose to it whatsoever.
You're the same reason why Hank Paulson's standing at the top of the pit with his weenie between his legs.
It puts the lotion on. It puts the lotion on.
See, you're just like him.
Yeah, but I'm the Wicked Witch of the East. I'm the good witch.
How can you say you're the Wicked Witch of the East and be good? You're wicked.
Because, you know,
it's a black and white world, Max.
I like to parse
it's
words.
It's only good
anyway,
and evil.
I want to freaking parse words. And that's all for now. Bye, y'all!